is Tom Romano from Miami University, where I teach undergraduates and graduates in a writing course. I've been a Heinemann author for 22 years and published my last memoir with them called Zigzag. And I am talking with Penny Kittle, who is a high school English teacher and K-12 literacy coach in Conway, New Hampshire. She's written The Greatest Catch and Public Teaching and also Inside Writing with Don Graves. And her most latest book is Right Beside Them, Risk, Voice, and Clarity in High School Writing. And Penny and I are going to talk about the topic of Can Voice Be Taught? Penny, are you there?
I'm here. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Well, what do you think about this, Can Voice Be Taught, that elusive quality of writing that even today so many students and teachers ask me, you know, what is voice exactly? And our late friend and mentor Don Murray maintained that the reason we go back to particular authors again and again was because of their voice.
Boy, I think that's true in my reading life. I've just been rereading Anne Lamott's books, and I read it because of her voice. I do believe in voice, and I believe it can be taught. It's funny that today I had a student's reflection on one of her writing pieces on my desk, and she said that it was the first piece she'd written without her serious high school voice, that she felt like she could find a voice that wasn't the voice she'd used for the last 3 years.
I wanted to ask you, Penny, how did you set up a situation in the classroom so that she felt like she could do that?
Well, I was thinking about the very first day of class, I have students try to find voice in a study guide that I give them for the course. It's like a course syllabus. And I ask them to, in one colored pencil, find elements of voice, and in another, to underline things they think are important. And a number of kids will say, what is voice? I've forgotten. What is it? Do you have a rubric? And I'll say, listen for when you think you can hear a person talking in the text, when you hear a real person. And they'll struggle with it a bit. And as we start that first unit in story, I flood them with mentor texts that are written by really strong-voiced authors like Sherman Alexie. I think it was from you, Tom, that I first read My Indian Education. Do you remember that piece?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And he has such a strong sense of his control over his own story through the power of this storytelling voice. And we talk about where do we hear him as we read Sherman, and then we read pieces by Rick Riley, Barbara Kingsolver, Stephen King. We even read one by Harold Bloom, because Harold Bloom, of course, has this very serious professor voice. And if you give them enough contrast, they begin to be able to identify what it is that makes, you know, which words, which phrases can
yeah.
make voice.
Yeah, see, I think that, you know, that professorial voice, even the corporate voice that we might hear that's so distant, and, you know, it's like nobody is really writing the text, I think that's a voice.
Yeah.
Just like those personal voices that we have when we read Murray or Don Graves. You mentioned that you had the kids look at the syllabus for a voice.
Yeah.
When I taught at Utah State, one of the surprises I got when I was the first year I taught was I gave the kids the syllabus and I asked them to write a one pager about the syllabus and what was in it and what was required. And when I got those one pagers the next day, one of the girls said, I can't believe it. My syllabus has a voice, which I thought was a pretty big compliment because I worked very hard on that.
Yeah, absolutely.
To sound like me and reflect my values and my way of saying.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's funny that on that first day, there's a line in my syllabus where I say, come to my office if you need help, bring cookies. Mm-hmm. And they will always say, bring cookies is when I can hear a person, like the way we would talk on the street.
Yeah.
And I think that it's as simple as that. Find the phrases, and then let's really talk. You know, I ask kids to say, where does that voice draw you in, draw you near, and where does a voice put distance between you and either the subject or the writing piece or the writer? Because I think that happens in all kinds of different texts. If they're editorials and they really want to, like, bring you into their point of view. They'll use a voice that's really welcoming and you've got to agree with me, or there's a voice that's very lecturing, that is,
yeah.
You know, you idiot, how could you not believe this?
You know, when I got to college as a 18-year-old, I was really adept at putting on war paint, using the biggest words I could use and the most abstract thinking I could conjure, because I thought that's what an educated, really good writer did. And, of course, I had some good writing teachers, and they didn't want any part of that.
Yeah. And you know, my students struggle to bring their own voice to a story, but I always use Murray's advice that if you ask whatever age, first grade to graduate school, he'd say, any age student to write about what really matters to them, their voice emerges because they have something to tell you. And I believe in that because I will say to kids, you're going to write the most important thing that you have to say, the biggest elephant in the room of your soul. You know, tell me the story that you most want to tell, and then your voice will appear because it's your story.
And you find that happens?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I find that it happens in those quick writing things that we do in notebooks. They'll burst onto the page, and I'll think, wow, who is this writer? And then when they try to develop a longer piece, they'll struggle with keeping, as Murray called it, the music of the text. You know how voice was musical? And it will tend to vary, like too much for a reader. And you'll have to get them to kind of tune in to what are you trying to do here. I find that it's complicated to teach, but it's so important to teach.
See, I have this, I love that idea of the quick write. And, you know, I've all through my own journal, I see where my voice comes through when I'm hot on a topic and writing at the top of my lungs. And yet, there's part of me also, Penny, that loves to craft the voice on the page to be like I want to be. You know, in my speech, I am often stumbling, or I can't think of the right word, or I take too long to say something. And when I write, after I've, you know, trusted the gush and gotten the words out, I like to go back and tinker with the language and with the sentences to see if I can get it to sound like I want to sound.
Absolutely.
Revision plays a huge part in my writing process and my establishing of a voice.
Well, I found myself before, I can remember writing the chapter on punctuation and grammar in the Right Beside Them book, and I had been reading a really snarky editorialist that was writing about fashion and was just destroying all these women who'd worn gowns to some awards show and their taste and the style. And her voice was so right, like a sucker punch to your gut kind of feel. And I started writing in my notebook about punctuation and grammar, about how, come on, everybody, just do it, just teach it. And I found this kind of sense of what I wanted to say in the voice that I chose. And that was just so interesting because I started with voice there instead of...
Now, a voice that you chose.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
We do make those choices.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Bill Strong used to say, he would talk about the tenor of your writing and that we adjust and tune the writing, our voices, depending on the audience that we were writing to and for.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I was thinking about this, Tom, with your writing, because if you think about when I read Writing with Passion, there is such a gentle, come see what I'm doing, I have these beautiful stories to tell you voice in that book. And then when I read Crafting Authentic Voice, there's a little bit of a, okay, come on, stop with the stuff that's not important. You know, you wrote the five-paragraph You Know What in that book.
Yeah.
What a great essay, and it just, you know, takes after a practice that isn't great for kids, and that voice is very different than the other book.
You know, when I was thinking about writing Crafting Authentic Voice, I thought that would be my next book. That was about 2003 that I was thinking about it. And, you know, I had been writing about voice in one way or another, I think, since I was in the seventh grade. I found out that I was in study hall with a group of kids. We had to be absolutely silent. And this friend of mine who sat up the aisle from me about two seats and one row over, we started to write short stories for each other in which you know, we were writing about what we knew, and in 1960, that would have been World War II, because we watched all these movies about World War II. So we were all soldiers in our battalion. And I would write these stories, and Jackie would write the story, and then we would trade the stories, and all of us, Jackie would turn around and smile broadly because he had detected himself in this adventure story I had written. And I discovered, I couldn't have articulated it then, but I discovered how to set my voice out there, send it out there, without me being present, and somebody could get the sound of what I meant and what I had to say.
And it was your voice, not voices of characters, but like a narrator voice.
Right, right.
Interesting.
Yeah. A real serious, driving World War II documentary voice, I think.
I was thinking about your essay, My Father's Voice.
Yeah.
Because I've used that as a quick writing activity in my classroom so much where I read that essay to them and ask them to think about the number of ways you talk about the qualities of your father's voice and the situations that would cause one particular voice to rise. Which is what we do in writing, right? It's the situation or the content of what you're saying and the voice that comes from that. And then they write the voice of someone they know. And I just find it so powerful because it comes at so many different things that they have to say about the world through the voice of one person.
You know, Penny, you've made me start to use that piece in my own teaching. I mean, I wrote it, and I was happy to write it and send it to you, and you used it with kids, and I thought, hey, I should try that too. So I've been using that as a quick write with my own students because of your teaching.
That's
when I was writing that book, before I started to write it, and I had time off from Miami to write, the first thing I thought was, I had all these files and all these examples of great writing, and I thought, well, what is voice? And I started to go to the voices of writers of essays, books of essays that I really liked and really responded to. And you mentioned Annie Lamott. I went to her books, nonfiction. And I went to Barbara Kingsolver and Michael Pollan, and I started to look at what was it that was so appealing about these voices that made them come right off the page and just draw me into their world. And I came up with that all of those voices had a little bit of narrative in them, even if it was a nonfiction piece, an essay. There often was a little narrative, a little story. There was plenty of information, and Don Murray would always say that it was, that readers were bottom feeders, and they were hungry for information.
Uh-huh.
And I saw that they often, those voices had surprise in them based on something they had perceived that they reported to the reader that surprised them. And I think surprised the writer also, in addition to the reader. And then the last quality that I noted was, and this is one that I've since thought maybe I should have just said this is a possibility but not a necessity for voice, but humor. So many voices that I love have a little bit of lightness or wit or playfulness to them.
That's so true for me, yeah. Playfulness with language and with words. I love that piece you wrote, How to Write, because you use so many great words that capture different parts of the process, but with really rich, vivid kinds of verbs. And it feels like you're somebody at the workbench crafting this piece.
There's that quality in your writing, too. My students, my undergraduates, Penny, are reading right beside them. And, you know, I should have mentioned that subtitle, Risk, Voice, and Clarity in High School Writing. And the other day after we read the first couple of chapters, one of the young women in the class said, "This is a yam of a methods book." And that was, we had read that poem by Marge Piercy called The Woman in the, And she, remember I sent you that?
Oh, yeah.
And she talked about a yam of a woman of butter and brass. And Katie said, this is a yam of a methods book. I want a Penny Kittle tattoo. So they've been on. They've been out in the field for 2 weeks. I have to see when she comes back if she got that tattoo yet.
Oh, that's funny.
But Penny, you seem to put it. You seem to put so much together in writing right beside them. I mean, it just seems like the culmination of everything you've been living and doing in your teaching and your personal life of writing in this book. And I wondered how you thought to embark on such a project.
You know, it came from Inside Writing, and the vision came from the video for Inside Writing, because watching teachers and kids and talking about teachers who write with kids and what happens in their classrooms, Dawn and I had said from the start that it should be K through college, that it should be practice that exists in all classrooms that teach writing. And how could we envision that? And I kept thinking that, you know, I should do a high school version or a middle high school version of what we had done in Inside Writing. And I played with that for a really long time, and I had no courage at all to write the book, and started writing little bits of it, really, and thinking about what are all the parts that I would include. And the other thing that I have to say really drove me were students that had found great success in their writing, that had never felt like they could be writers, that had come to life in 18 weeks in a semester.
That's and exhilarating,
like,
isn't it?
Yeah, it's like there's something here that I can help other people see. And if we could just balance English, high school English classrooms better between literature and true writing as its own subject, its own territory, I think we could help kids feel like they had this voice. So it never felt, I still wish I could revise it. You know, as Murray would say, you just have to move on. You have to abandon it and move on. I still, if I read a passage from it, want to get my pencil out and work on it. But
oh, I'll tell my students that and their mouths will be agape. You know, you mentioned those kids that they really come to life when they write some particular thing, often in a quick write when they write about what matters. And, you know, one of the great moments for me in teaching is when I am having a conference with a student, and our interaction and our conversation about their piece and what I'm seeing in it, when I see them quicken with interest to what they have put on the page, that is an exhilarating moment for me as a teacher.
I agree. When kids have found, they have said to me, you don't know how many times, Ms. Kittle, this isn't about a grade. I have to get this right. That is just so exciting. You know they're on a journey to say something with words, and that journey can light so many paths in their future. And I will say to them, what I'm trying to give you is skills that will help you no matter what kind of a writing project you're handed in the future, because we can't anticipate what those are with this changing world of, you know, digital literacies. And but I want you to know how to get to what you're trying to say, that process.
Penny, you mentioned skills, and I want to take this. I remember years ago, Don Graves, and I'm talking like 25 years ago perhaps, when I was a graduate student the first time around at UNH, and I remember Don meeting with a group of parents and community members at a school, and somebody asked him about skills and why aren't the kids learning skills? And he said, well, what skills are you talking about? And he meant that, you know, there's skills of drafting and revising and searching for ideas that most people don't mean when they talk about skills. They're talking about grammar, usage, and punctuation.
Yeah.
But even with the grammar, usage, and punctuation, I mean, people think that I am opposed to that some way. And I look at those elements as ways to help kids express themselves more powerfully. But not just picking out adverbs and verbs and introductory adverbial clauses for the sole purpose of being able to identify them, but how might those aspects of language help them express themselves better, more powerfully?
Absolutely. We talk about tools all the time and about how a reader hears the piece because of the directions you give them in punctuation. And do you want this part to slow down? And let me read this to you the way you've written it. Is all the, you know, those conversations are how I teach punctuation, as well as, you know, get together with a partner and put these four sentences into one sentence that combines ideas and, you know, that kind of thing where they have to use a little creativity and manipulate things to remember how things can go together. And I certainly don't use words like subordinate clauses and things like that very often because I think that that's distancing language.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about the voice of how we teach punctuation. But I'm always talking about if I read this and I'll read it aloud to them, the way you punctuated it, I'm not making sense. And so that power that they have to determine how someone hears what they have to say is a real power.
So, you know,
I have a question for you.
Well, oh, okay.
No, you can follow. You can.
Well, I was just going to say, when you said hears, I don't know that how successful. I know I'm successful on a few occasions because I make them do it in class, but I think that one of the most powerful things the individual writer can do is to read her work aloud.
Yep.
All of my books, there is a point, usually many points, in which I have read every word of those books aloud, sitting before the computer often with my hands in my lap, reading aloud to try to hear the bongs and the bings and the parts that flow and the parts that just don't make sense. I just think the ear is such an incredible tool that a lot of our students, I think they blow right by that in their haste to print that sucker out, as one of my students called it.
Well, I would say I was one of those students. I can remember clearly, Tom, Don Murray calls me the night before my first book signing and says, "What are you going to read?" And I said, "Oh, I can't decide. I'm just tortured by this." And he said, "Well, which ones sound the best read out loud?" And I didn't want to answer. I didn't want to confess. And I was, you know, stumbling around, and I said, "Don, I haven't read these out loud." He said, "What? That's an essential part of your process." And I had never really thought of that. And when
which book was that, Penny?
Public Teaching. And
uh-huh.
I started reading those essays aloud, and I was like, "Oh, my word, there's so much more revising to do." You know, you can hear it differently. So now I do. Yes, I do. I read aloud. In fact, I had my fourth graders read their quick write entries to themselves aloud after we finished writing them today and talked about what that does for a writer. I think it's essential.
Yeah.
Took me a long time to learn it, though. So here's my question for you. I often hear teachers say, "I don't like the term voice. I think that what you're talking about is style." And how would you, distinguish between those?
Oh, man. You know, Murray, I remember Murray had a pat answer for this. Do you remember that?
I do.
Yeah, he'd say style is something you buy off the rack.
Yep.
It's what's fashionable. Oh, I don't know. That's a pretty good answer. But voice and style, audience, you know, like I said, you know, the voice that I express in my notebook when I'm writing rapidly is not, there are things in that voice that I love a lot. It's me. It reflects my neighborhood and my education and my dealings with colleagues and how I talk to friends. But then there's also that aspect of, you know, that I want to tune that a little bit. I want to make it sound like the me I want to be at now 60 years old. So I don't know. I don't know how, if I can answer that. I mean, Murray's answer is about the best between voice and style for me.
Yeah.
Although style doesn't, I guess style doesn't put me off as much as it did Don. Let me throw it back to you. What do you think about it?
You know, I always used to think that the ultimate in writing was to be able to write in a style like Jane Austen.
Mm-hmm.
Because I longed for this Victorian life I would never have, and I wanted to be so sophisticated and well-mannered. And it really had nothing to do with the structure of her sentences. It had to do with a period of time she lived in. And so I think of style as being a quality that can encompass a whole lot of things written in the same time period or for the same purpose. and that a voice is so individual, and that there is only one Jane Austen. She writes in a style that I read a lot of in my master's program because I love British literature, but there is also an individual stamp that is her, that is funky. And I think that we each carry an individual stamp based on all these myriad of experiences and life choices and challenges, and that voice is what makes readers want to listen.
And the culture of our times.
Absolutely.
The kids that I teach today are living in a very different culture than I did, and even that I do now, because
yeah.
I am so out of it in so much of what they value and do and work at.
Yeah.
Did you ever read, I've never read this, but I wondered, are there any Jane Austen journals, notebooks that she kept?
Yeah, it's mostly like all of her letters to Cassandra, her sister.
Well,
Those are the ones where you get the unscripted Jane.
So what's that voice like compared to Jane Austen in her novels?
It feels very similar to me. It feels similar and yet freer and a little more intimate, because you can hear the sisterly relationship. And she writes with such authority. It's a truth universally acknowledged. The single man in possession of a large fortune must be in want of a wife. Anyone to start a novel like that is so sure of what they have to say.
And that's what comes through in her notebooks, too?
No, in her letters you hear much more of a sister talking to another sister about how are things and, what things are happening. You hear it every once in a while. I feel like it's Jane, but it is definitely more intimate the way letters would be.
Did you ever, did you tell me that you tried to emulate her style ever?
You know what I tried to do is write a story about background characters from Pride and Prejudice, because I love the book so much. So I wanted to write Georgiana's story, which is Darcy's younger sister.
It
was horrible.
When I was in a sophomore in college, the professor he had just about had it with us, and he instructed us to go to the library, and he said, "I want you to come back. Your next piece of writing, I want you to write a little piece in the voice of Hemingway, a little piece in the voice of Faulkner, and a little piece in the voice of Henry James. No women, you note." But, I did that. I knew Hemingway, but I had to go read Faulkner and Henry James. And when I was doing that assignment, in the style, in the voices, in the style of those writers, I was most proud of my Hemingway voice. Because I was just discovering him and that spare kind of style. And, I handed in the paper, and the next class period, he had them graded, and he read some examples that he thought were good anonymously, and he read my Henry James. And, I remember having fun with that, but, it fed right into my, remember what I told you my writing was like when I got to college, full of big words and adverbs and convoluted sentences and all that? He liked that, so that's what I'll never forget that.
You had an activity in the Crafting Authentic Voice course that I took at UNH with you. You had us find a quote, a couple of sentences from a book that we loved, and I chose something from Anne Lamott, and you had us take it and then write something that we had to say using her sentence structure. So if there was a colon, we had to have a colon, and we had to have a list, and we had to follow the pattern of what she'd done. And it was so instructive for me of how things go together and how do you make something your own that wasn't your own.
I've forgotten that assignment, Penny.
It was a good one.
You make my teaching here. You've pointed out an assignment that I gave that I forgot that I gave. I'll be using that this week.
There you go.
Yeah. Well, listen, is there anything else you want to say about can voice be taught?
I think that a teacher needs to hear her own voice on the page and then play with that voice. And, of course, I'm going to say in a notebook because I love mine, but that I think that as we understand how to use our own voice in writing, that then we can teach it. I just think that's the tool.
You know, that's essential. And I want to let me end this with a little story involving a friend of ours. Last summer, when I taught the multi-genre course at UNH, we talked about teacher as writer. And, you know, we've been talking about that and writing about that for years and years. I think there was even an NCTE book called Teacher as Writer. And some of the teachers in the group felt uneasy about that. One woman said, you know, I play music, but I would not call myself a musician. And we had just been reading Tom Newkirk's new book, Holding On to Good Ideas in a Time of Bad Ones. And even in that book, Tom says that he easily calls himself a reader, but he hesitates to call himself a writer. At that point in our group, Maya Wilson, you know, Rethinking Rubrics?
Oh, yeah.
Maya speaks up and says, don't make it a noun, make it a verb. Not, I'm a writer, but I write. And I thought, if all of us would embrace that stance, we would have to look at writing, teaching writing, completely different than we would if we were just thinking about the five-paragraph you-know-what or matching state standards or some graduation test.
Yeah. You know, I think that, and I have quoted Maya so many times since this summer, because I think that's the essential thing in teaching as well. You know, so many people say to a class of students, you can all be writers, and they imagine themselves as novelists. And it doesn't have to be that. We can all write, and we can write things that matter and write well as a verb. And that tends to give all kids the power to enter that community instead of just the ones who can see themselves as authors and novelists.
Right, we've got to get rid of that kind of elitist notion, you know?
Yeah. I think it's better when we struggle right beside them than to create the great text and bring it in.
Although we want to do that, too.
That's kind of hard.
we want to write the... Listen, how could you say that when you've got right beside them out there?
Well, you're very nice.
Okay, listen, it has been great chatting with you, Penny, and I will see you at NCTE in, where are we going? Philadelphia.
I don't know, but we'll be in touch.
Okay.
All right. See you, Tom.
Bye-bye.